And now, for the moment you've all been waiting for. Da di da di li da di li da di li da di li da di da di li da di li da di li da di li da di da di li da di li da di li da di li da di da di da di da di li da di li da di li da di li da di da di li 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 da. This is not clickbait. I don't clickbait. You can ask my friends. So, surprise everyone. You're about to get so much Odd Ones content this year. I've been contractually obligated to keep this a secret from you for a long time now, but today's the day I'm finally allowed to tell you that we're making a Netflix show. We, meaning the entire team of amazing and talented people who worked on this show in every department, who consistently improved the quality with everything they did. This project would not have been possible without everyone's amazing work, so thank you. Oh, and speaking of amazing teams, give it up for the YouTube team who's been working hard on these videos while I've been busy on this. It takes a village to raise a child and make a season of a cartoon show. How did this all happen, I hear you ask? Well, it all started when I partnered up with a television writer named Ethan Banville, and together we came up with a show about a boy who looks and sounds and is named after me, and a crocodile.
A crocodile? You mean like the one that was in your music video, Life is Fun? Have you been working on this since 2018?
Oh, no, no, no. I mean, kind of. We pitched the show to Netflix in early 2020, but we didn't get the green light until August of 2020. So that means the entire production has been done in lockdown. All the writing, the storyboarding, the designing, the voice acting has been done with little to no human interaction. I still have yet to work in an office. I just want to lean against a water cooler and say things like, "Yo, did you catch the game last night? Is that too much to ask?" And before I go, I just wanted to thank all of you for watching my videos. I've always wanted to entertain people with cartoons, and without you watching these cartoons and supporting me, I wouldn't have had this amazing opportunity. I'm sure you're all dying to see what the team's been working on, but you'll have to wait. I will be going to some conventions in the next few months, and I plan on showing more teasers of the show until its release in sometime later this year. You can visit my website in the description and check out the new items, along with signing up for emailed updates as we get closer to the premiere date. I'm still going to post regular videos here on YouTube. Like I said earlier, I have an amazing team working on these YouTube videos. It's just, this is why it's been longer between uploads, okay? Thank you all again, and I hope you enjoy the show. When you watch it. Later this year. And if you're planning on going to VidCon in Anaheim this year, I will be showing exclusive clips and storyboards at my panel. That's only in, like, a couple of days. You don't even have to wait that long. But if you really want to see something and you just can't wait, then I guess...
Go!
See, everything worked out.
Oh, I want to be a ladder!
I hate you!
Oh! Well, next time, don't steal my Monopoly!
Ariana, give James your $200 you landed on his property.
No! He's in jail! I'm not gonna give money to a criminal! That's not how you...
Mommy, why is brother screaming?
Shut the f*** up, Sally. You don't get to talk after stealing my last railroad! I wish I was never born! Me too! You think I wanted this?
Hi, what you all just witnessed is the phenomenon known as Family Game Night. Family Game Night plays an important role in the household dynamic, as studies have shown that families who participate in activities together form closer bonds and stronger relationships with each other. So try setting aside some time to play board games with your family. And if they beat you, cut them out of your life forever. Okay, have fun, you guys.
I like board games. I guess any game that doesn't involve me getting up and moving around, I'm a huge fan of. Also, since I'm bad at everything and don't like playing games against someone who's better than me, I really love the games that don't require any type of skill, like the game Chutes and Ladders, which I just learned today has another name called Snakes and Ladders. And I'm going to call it that instead, because I'd rather draw snakes than... chutes? In Snakes and Ladders, you have no free will. You're at the mercy of a single dice, and I love it. While I was looking up walkthroughs for Snakes and Ladders, I quickly learned that this game was made for preschoolers, which is probably why it's so simple. Or how about the game Sorry, which is the most unapologetic game I've ever played? There's some strategy in that game, but most of the time you're just getting revenge on the players who've wronged you. And the creators of Sorry knew this because the tagline of the game is Sorry, the game of sweet revenge. Which, if you think about it, is a pretty funny oxymoron. Aha! Take this! Sorry. I know how to play chess, but like most things, I'm not very good at it. Unless I'm playing against someone under the age of 4, I don't want to play that game. Because it shows everyone how bad I am at planning ahead. That's a game that's 100% strategy-based. It's like the IQ test of board games. Beating someone in chess will put you more ahead academically than anyone with a Harvard degree. And you'll get more babes. However, there is one exception, and that is, it's okay to lose at chess if you're playing against a computer, even if it's on easy mode. Computers are way better at planning ahead than anyone, because I don't know how, but a human made a computer that can beat the world's best chess player, but the creator of the computer can't beat the world's best chess player. So I guess that means it's game over. We tried our best, but we've peaked. Whenever you beat a computer in chess, it was going easy on you. Imagine if we made a computer that could beat the world's best Snakes and Ladders player. I would pay money to see a Snakes and Ladders championship. And everyone watching knows that the person playing is just some Joe Schmo that acts like the world's best Snakes and Ladders player, but they're all still excited. And there's real snakes that you get to slide down? That would be amazing! Sign me up. While we're on the topic of chess, I want to tell you about this cool sport I discovered called chess boxing. This is an actual competitive sport where two players play chess for 3 minutes, then box each other for 3 minutes. And they keep switching between chess and boxing until someone either gets a checkmate, they run out of time playing chess, or they KO the other player. I love this sport because it combines two polar opposite games, and it's something that anyone can play. Brains over brawn? Try saying that after I sucker punch you in the... Oh, that was a good move. I'm gonna punch you so hard in the balls for that. I know I just said I was bad at chess, but if there's any YouTubers who want to challenge me to a chess boxing match, I will gladly take you to the ring, and we can charge people $12 just to watch. And we can end it in a draw, you know, so that way you won't look bad in front of your fans. So Battleship, that's another board game, and it also got a big Hollywood movie based off of it. I haven't seen it, but I hope there's a scene where the captain of the ship goes, "Men, fire at... D6? And then there's an explosion in the distance, and then Rihanna, who is actually in that movie, says, "Sir, the alien sent a message. It says, miss." And the captain goes, Someone write that down so we don't forget. And then there'll be an explosion at the back of their ship, and alarms start going off, and everyone on board starts freaking out except for the captain, and he goes, "Rihanna, send the aliens a message. Tell them... Also, ask them if they think the situation would make a good board game. And if that scene is not in the movie, I hate it. Did anyone else collect a bunch of Pokemon cards, but never knew how to play the game? I don't think I met a single person who actually knew how to play the card game. Which was weird, because in my school, the card game was just as popular as the video games. Kids would always show off their collection of cards and binders, and everyone always wanted the highly coveted shiny Charizard card. You know which one I'm talking about. You know which one I'm talking about. You know which one I'm talking about! Unlike Yu-Gi-Oh!, which had dedicated episodes explaining why these 5 pieces of cardboard were expensive, the shiny Charizard was rare, not because it was good in the game, but because everyone agreed that it looked cool. But then when you ask someone, "Hey, do you want to play a game?" they would say, "Okay, I summon my Charizard in attack mode." Does anyone even know how to play the Pokemon card game? I bet none of these guys even know what they're doing. How'd this guy win? He didn't even call Uno. I can't be too hard on the Pokemon cards, because the card game I like is probably way more complicated than Pokemon. I don't know for sure, because, like I said, I don't know how to play the Pokemon card game, but my favorite card game is Neopets. I'm just kidding, that was a joke. Kind of. I did actually own a lot of Neopet cards. I don't remember exactly how to play. I do remember you have to get 21 points to win, which got me into playing blackjack. But it's okay that I don't remember how to play, because no one else is playing this game. I wanted to find some footage of a Neopet TGC championship, only to come to the disappointing realization that no Neopet championship exists, which is sad. So, if there's any YouTubers watching who want to fight my Scorchio, square up. Okay, but for real, the card game I like the most is Magic the Gathering. And fun little factoid, all three card games I've mentioned were created by the same company, Wizards of the Coast. Hey, is that a Monopoly reference? I've been playing Magic since 2007, and back then the game was a lot more simple. Look at some of these more recent cards. First, see how many words are on them? And if we flip them over, they merge into an even bigger card. What? If you showed these cards to my 11-year-old self, I would have lost my marbles. My favorite thing about Magic is when Dick Garfield, was first creating the game in 1993, he didn't really have an accurate way of testing the cards to make sure they're all fair and balanced, and he ended up creating some of the most overpowered cards in Magic. And players today refer to these cards as the Power 9, because there are 9 really good ones, which is why every single one of them is banned. Now, don't get me wrong, the Power 9 are good cards, but none of them are like, you win the game good. Take this one for example, Ancestral Recall. All it says is, draw 3 cards, or force opponent to draw 3 cards. Which is stupid that they added that last part. Why would you ever give your opponent 3 more cards to beat you with? Now, I know what you're thinking. Wait, a slightly better Pot of Greed, which is a card that allows me to draw 2 new cards from my deck and place them into my hand, is one of the top 9 most powerful Magic cards? Yeah, Pot of Greed is banned too. Games play such an important role in childhood, and here's what they all teach us. In Magic, if you're really good at what you do, no one will invite you to their tournament. Monopoly, white-collar crime is okay. Battleship, just guess and check. Snakes and ladders, if you see a ladder, climb it immediately. And no one cares about Neopets. Now, if you excuse me, I have to show this prison guard my coupon I have that lets me get out of jail anytime I like.
I'm terrible at decorating. Not in the sense that I have terrible taste, but rather, I'm terrible doing anything. I have this debilitating habit where right before I hang a picture up on a wall, I'll go, yeah, this spot is perfect. I'll just set this on the floor real quick so I remember this is the spot I'm going to hang it up. And then that picture will stay on the floor for 6 months until I finally do hang it up, which takes less than 5 minutes to do so. Sometimes though, I'll get into a home decoration overhaul kind of mood. Like recently, I've come into the possession of 30 Warrior Cat books. Somehow. And instead of putting them in a closet next to my 30 Animorph books, I decided it was finally time to buy a bookshelf and put all of my classic literature neatly on display. After perusing multiple furniture websites and getting overwhelmed with the massive amount of choices and styles and letting my algorithm know I was desperate for a new shelving unit, I had a sudden moment of clarity. I am spending more time thinking about shelves than I've ever wanted to in my entire life. I just need something to hold my cat books. Why am I overcomplicating this? I should check old reliable IKEA. Ooh, this looks nice. The Calyx. Now, I could just pay to have this thing delivered straight to my door, or I could go on a fun adventure filled with meatballs. The older you get, the more fun going to IKEA gets. Any piece of furniture you can possibly imagine is at IKEA, with a ridiculous name. In my head, this was going to be the quickest IKEA trip of my life. I would eat some meatballs that are so delicious you don't even need spaghetti to go with them. Then I would find my Calyx and take it home. If I had 2 birds right now, I could totally kill them with 1 stone. Or meatball. But if you know anything about IKEA, a quick IKEA trip is an oxymoron. The first red flag that this trip was going awry was that as I was standing in the checkout line with my food on my lunch tray, I couldn't help but notice that even though I asked for the 12 meatball meal, I only counted 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 meatballs on my plate. Now I had to ask myself an important question. Am I the type of guy who will step out of line, walk back to the server, and say, I don't know how you Swedes count, but here in the States... And before I even finished the hypothetical, I figured, no, I'm not that type of guy. But then, like, more minor inconveniences kept happening. After I completed my incomplete meal, I went to fill up my water bottle at one of those water filling stations. But when I put my bottle in, the flow of water, like, curved to the side. But then when I moved my bottle over to where the water was going, it wouldn't be under the sensor, so I had to do this whole dance where I kept activating and moving my water bottle, and by the time my bottle was half full, I remember thinking, I wish this machine just didn't work. Because then I would just go, oh, guess it doesn't work. But now it's making me work for my hydration. But Whatever. This is all just part of the IKEA experience and why it's such a magical place. Right? I skipped grabbing a shopping cart and started blazing through all the neatly designed showrooms that I'm usually a huge sucker for.
Wow. I wish my bedroom looked like a Scandinavian child's bedroom.
I'm not doing any of that today. I had one item on my mind, and that was the one and only easy-to-pronounce Calyx. Now, imagine my surprise when I turned a corner and saw an entire showroom called the Calyx Collection. Maybe if I had been more observant and saw the giant Calyx display at the front of the store, or just looked on the website for two more seconds, I would have learned that Calyx is like the name of a type of bookshelf, and they come in all these different shapes and sizes, and oh no, I'm overwhelmed with choices again. I saw they were also selling these cubbies that could go into the shelves, and I thought, now I gotta get a cart. If you don't know, IKEA is a one-way street. Arrows illuminate the floor, indicating the flow of traffic. And even though I was robbed of a meatball, I was still willing to respect the rules of the road, and I did a full lap around the store. And I'm super glad I put in the work to fill up my water bottle, because this mega store was a lot more mega than I remember. I kept following the arrows, but I swear they were making me go in circles. I am not surprised that there is a never-ending IKEA SCP, because as you walk through a regular IKEA, you definitely get worried that this place will never end. But the real problem going through all the showrooms twice was that it doubled my chances to see a piece of furniture and go, oh, I actually could use that. There has got to be a Swedish word for going to IKEA for one item and then leaving with $1,000 worth of furniture. There was an end table that I swear had a spotlight shining directly on it. I could hear Swedish angels singing. This end table would be perfect for my printer, which is currently on the floor. So after two laps of the showroom, I headed to the giant warehouse to pick up my stuff, and there were these shelf dividers I wanted, which were ironically at the very back of this long shelf themselves. And by this point in my journey, I was kind of done playing by IKEA's rules, so I just climbed up in there and got them myself. What was I supposed to do? Ask someone for help and make them crawl up in there? No. Now, that amazing end table that I wanted for my printer had to be picked up in the order pickup area for some reason. I guess they had it in the super secret employee only warehouse. So I showed the guy my receipt, and my name appeared on a screen along with an estimated time my order would be ready, which was in 10 minutes. So I waited 10 minutes, and the guy never called my name. And I thought, I'm not bothered by this. It was an estimate. It's fine being a few minutes late. Then more time passed. And by this point, it had been 10 minutes after my estimated 10-minute wait time. So I go up to the guy and said, listen, I can let the meatball slide. But did you forget about me? And he was like, oh, yeah, we're just waiting on someone who can operate a forklift. Do you want me to climb up there? I added 45 minutes to my quickest IKEA trip to get something I came into the store not originally wanting. I didn't even measure if my printer would fit, so I was kind of taking a gamble there. But good news, it totally fits, so. However, even with all those minor inconveniences I had to deal with, something happened in that IKEA that really stuck out to me and, dare I say, made the whole trip worth it. After I had done my first lap of the showroom and secured a shopping cart, I saw this middle-aged woman with who I'm assuming was her mom in a wheelchair, and she was grabbing all these small items in her bare hands, and even though I had traveled very far for this shopping cart, I asked her, do you need a shopping cart?
Oh yes, that would be very helpful, thank you.
I'm doing a voice, that's not how she sounded. After I gave her mine, I did just turn around and went against the flow of traffic to grab another shopping cart. I'm only running on 11 meatballs here, I'm not doing that a third time. But then later, when I was down in the warehouse, I was about to put this big box into my cart when that same woman just so happened to be there and asked, do you need any help? And it made me realize that a simple act of kindness can be so meaningful to someone that it can completely change the type of day they're having. Admittedly, I did end up putting that box back because I realized it was in the wrong color. I'm sorry for making you crawl up in there, Grandma. Sometimes we get so wrapped up in decorating our room or scrolling on our phone that we forget the real world is out there. So go out and do something nice for someone today. It'll make both of you feel a lot better. And if you have any pictures just leaning up against a wall, go hang them up right now. It'll take like 2 seconds.
I'm sort of stealing this idea from Jaden Animations.
Wait, no, that's not right. I'm not stealing it. I'm plagiarizing it.
Jaden did a video talking about random thoughts she had, and you should all go watch it. And I thought, hey, I think randomly sometimes. So Jaden, is it alright if I make a video about my random thoughts? I hope you say yes, because I just did. What is happiness? Well, it's a chemical in your brain. And how do you get that chemical? Well, it's just a little something I like to call drugs. I think humans make fun of hairless animals way too much. We think that all hairless animals are ugly. Just go to Google Images and type in hairless animal, and you'll probably think the animals you see there are ugly as well. But we all seem to forget that we're hairless animals too. If anything, other animals should think that we're ugly. So I look at this phenomenon and I have a theory. I think we humans find things covered in hair more cute. We're more attracted to things covered in hair. And that's why I'm a furry. My dad never taught me how to shave, and one time I cut myself shaving right above my lip, and for the rest of the day, all I could smell was blood. I don't know why I mentioned the dad part. You know how websites will ask you to type in a bunch of misshapen letters to make sure you're not a robot? That's called a CAPTCHA. And some of those CAPTCHAs are impossible. Sometimes I look at a CAPTCHA and think, am I a robot? I just wanted to send some email. I didn't want to question my identity. I wasn't ready for an existential crisis, Club Penguin. Sorry, that joke is dead. Just like Club Penguin. So here's the random thought. What if we lived in a robot society and robots had to prove that they weren't human to make a Facebook account? I think their CAPTCHA would be an optical illusion. Like, to sign into a website, it'll show two lines and say, prove you're not a human, which line is bigger? Optical illusions are like CAPTCHAs for people. Every time you paint a room, it gets a little bit smaller. And if it takes you one can of paint to paint an entire room, then the room gets smaller by one can of paint. You brought a can of paint inside the room, and you never took it out. Every time you smell something, molecules from that thing get sucked up into your nose, and that's how you're able to smell it. So that means every time you smell something, it gets a tiny bit lighter. Do archaeologists have lingo and jokes that only other archaeologists will understand? Like, there's a whole other world of jokes that I won't get to experience because I'm not an archaeologist. Like, one day, two archaeologists could be digging a hole, and one says, I'm not finding anything! And then the other guy says, well, you know what they say in the archaeology business. And I don't know what they say because I'm not an archaeologist. How about we look up jokes for archaeologists? Why did Robin Hood pull out of the archery contest? He found it an arrowing experience. Okay, get that one? It just wasn't that funny. Nor was it about archaeology. Or maybe it was, and I just don't get it. We'll never know. Where did Caesar keep his armies? Up his sleeveys. Okay, I had to get this one explained to me, but armies is supposed to be your arm, like your body arm, and your armies go up your sleeveys. Get it? Except Julius Caesar wore a toga, so he didn't even have sleeves. And you could just say this about anyone who had an army. Where did Hitler keep his armies? Up his sleeveys! Ha ha ha! When you ask someone what time it is, sometimes they'll say, it's a quarter to blank. And first off, I really hate that way of telling time, because now I have to use math just to know what time it is. Someone will say, it's a quarter to eight. Okay, so a quarter to eight, well, a quarter is 25, so 8 minus 25, it's like negative 13. Wait, no, we're using time numbers, so a quarter of 60, that's like 10 minutes, so 8 minus 60 over 4, you carry the 2, and... Oh, it's 8 o'clock now. We usually only say it's a quarter to when referring to whole numbers, but I wish people would use other times, like, hey, what time is it? Oh, it's a quarter to 8:37. Did you know that mosquitoes prefer type O blood more than any other blood type? Does that mean our blood tastes different? How can mosquitoes sense what blood type we are? Do mosquitoes think we come in different flavors? What if there was a restaurant for mosquitoes and the menus just had our blood types? Are there mosquito snobs? Like one mosquito would say, oh, I see you're drinking O negative. Of course you'd like that blood. Everyone likes that blood. I got that whole idea from a conversation I had with Jaden, and I said I was going to use it in my random thoughts video, so I'm just stealing everything from Jaden. You know what I think would be a funny contradiction?
A fedora with a Tumblr logo on it.
Whenever you leave for a trip, people will say, drive safe, which is fine. I always appreciate safe driving tips. But when you go flying in an airplane, sometimes people will say, have a safe flight. But I literally have no control if a plane flies safely or not. Why are you telling me to fly safe? I should be the one telling the pilot that.
Hey, I just wanted to say that a lot of my friends are counting on you, so you better not screw this up.
I appreciate the sentiment, but how do I fly unsafe? Maybe go on my phone before we take off? Not watch the safety video? Blow the plane up? Why do people care so much about fashion? If I bought some really nice clothes and I go to a party, out of everyone in that room, I'm the only one who can't see what I'm wearing, unless I look down the entire time. I can go to a party and be wearing just a bunch of clown makeup, and as long as there's no mirrors around and everyone plays it cool, I would have no idea that I'm wearing anything. And also, it doesn't matter what I'm wearing, because I look good in everything. I think this whole YouTube thing has given me a confidence boost. I wouldn't say it's an unhealthy amount, but it's given me confidence that I didn't have in high school. My parents bought me a Pokemon shirt for Christmas, and yeah, I like Pokemon, but I don't want the whole world to know that. And in high school, I wouldn't have worn any remotely geeky shirt. But now I can go outside and not even realize that I'm wearing my Pokemon shirt. And when I do realize, I usually think, huh, that's embarrassing. I'm the odd ones out, who cares? When my parents were my age, they already had a child. And here I am, wearing a Pokemon shirt. You know how different states in America will have different names for certain things? Like some states call it pop instead of soda, or how they call it a washroom instead of a bathroom, and apparently in Rhode Island they call a water fountain a bubbler, and everywhere else is just normal. Anyway, once I heard that down south, there's a phrase for when it's raining and the sun is still out. And that phrase is, the devil meeting his wife. Oh, isn't that so sweet? That means anyone can find happiness, even the devil. Ah, I love it when we give the devil more innocent and human characteristics. And given how few of times it rains in Arizona, I don't get to use that phrase very often. So already when it's raining, it's like, woo, it's raining, this day is gonna be great! But then when the sun's out, I get to say, look guys, the devil's meeting his wife! Ah, I hope they're happy together. Unfortunately, I misheard what that phrase was when I learned it. It's not the devil meeting his wife. It's actually the devil beating his wife. So I guess they're not happy together. I was so sad when I learned what it actually was. I don't know who this devil's wife is, but you need to find a new man, dude. And to think, I almost thought of you as an alright guy, Satan. I looked up that saying on Wikipedia, and in Tennessee they say, the devil is kissing his wife. So I guess in Tennessee, the devil's romantic, but everywhere else he just can't stand her. And the worst variation I could find has to be what they say in France. In France, when it rains and the sun's out, they say, the devil is beating his wife and marrying his daughter. Whoa, France! I'd expect that sort of behavior from Tennessee, but not you, France! Why do you have to be so dramatic to describe your weather? I don't want to even know what you call snowstorms. So anyway, those were my random thoughts. I swear I don't do drugs.
You might be thinking that me giving you advice on pitching a show is insincere or not applicable because of that. But listen, there was still a whole lot of work that went into my pitch for a TV show, and even with all my subscribers, statistically, I still got turned down way more times than I got picked up. If Netflix is just green-lighting everyone with a big sub count, then why doesn't I Did a Thing have a show, huh? Why doesn't Mr. Beast have a Netflix show? Oh, actually, he's doing just fine. By the way, if you are someone with a lot of subscribers, don't just walk into a studio and say, hey, I have a lot of subs, give me a show, okay? Walk in and say, hey, I have a lot of subs and free merchandise for you, okay? Diversification is key. Networks like Netflix, Cartoon Network, and Nickelodeon, they're in the biz of making content for their platform and in turn getting you, the viewer, to watch said content on said platform, thus generating a perpetual money-making cycle that everyone, including you, benefits from. Now, the executives in charge don't have all the time to come up with every single show they're going to make, so they turn to the general public, open their doors, and will listen to anyone pitch them their idea for a television series. But even if you have an Emmy-winning idea, if you're not able to properly sell your idea and win over the hearts of the network executives, it's not going to get picked up and developed. Then your only option is to independently fund and develop your idea yourself. But what kind of a loser would do that? And thus the art of pitching a show is born. You could honestly teach a whole class about this.
Now, obviously, you can't just walk into a studio empty-handed. All right, big idea. What if we do a show where there's a talking alligator, right? And he's like, yo, what? I'm a crocodile. You gotta come prepared, but also not be over-prepared. I was actually surprised to learn this, but going into the pitch room with finished scripts, turnarounds of your characters, and plushies will actually hurt your chances of getting picked up. The reason for this is because executives will sometimes like to change parts of your show, and if you already have all the characters and story mapped out, they'll not want to pick you up because they feel like they can't change anything. You're not even supposed to write any scripts until after you get the green light, because the executives have to approve all the scripts you make and the writers that you want to hire. So if you ever pitch a show, just be open for changes. Which, I can attest, is a very different experience to what it's like on YouTube. What you do want to bring to the pitch is this super important document called a show Bible, and then you need to convert to that show's religion. The show Bible is a document that contains everything your audience needs to know about your show. In the beginning of a show Bible, there should be a 1-2 sentence description that covers the main synopsis of your show. It's kind of like an elevator pitch, but here in the biz, we call it a log line. I'll give you mine as an example. When James's parents move them to a tiny desert town where eccentric scientific minds have been brought together to do unfettered experiments, James finds himself surrounded by the children of these scientists and the offspring of their experiments. The result? Unlike in his last town, James is no longer the oddest kid around. I don't know if the show's been out by the time this video comes out, but we kinda lost the new in town theme. Like I said, the executives want to make changes. After the logline, you write a page-long backstory where you go more in-depth with your idea. Answer questions like, who are the characters? What are their goals? Where do they live? Just general stuff, because after the backstory page, you're gonna write all about your characters. This is the part of the Bible where you can just go balls to the wall with details and description. Who, how, and why are your characters? What are their wants, needs, fears, flaws, likes, dislikes, and general personality traits? These are important traits to think about even if a specific detail isn't going to be reflected in the show. Like in my Bible for the crocodile, Max, some of the things we said he liked were the rain, raw chicken, and laying on warm rocks in the sun. Now, I don't think he got to enjoy a single one of those things in the show, but these are the types of questions you have to answer to get the clearest idea of who your characters are. You should also include drawings of your characters. This can help show their personality and body language, but just keep them to doodles, because again, be open, they can be... they're subjected to change. Next, there needs to be drawings and descriptions of specific locations that the characters spend a lot of time in. This will help show the overall world and tone of the show. And lastly, I know it's long, that's why it's called a show Bible and not a show pamphlet. You need to write out page-long episode ideas, not scripts. This will show the executives what a typical episode would look like and the direction and tone you want to go with the show. Honestly, there's so much that goes into a show Bible. I'm really only scratching the surface. If you are genuinely interested in pitching a show, or even a little interested in cartoons, then I would highly recommend looking at other show Bibles online for inspiration and how they should be formatted. It's pretty fun looking through older show Bibles and seeing the earliest versions of your favorite cartoons. This is what Mermaid Man and Barnacle Bill were going to look like. I mean, look, isn't that cool? Unfortunately, you can't just hand an executive your show Bible and silently wait for them to finish reading it. You also have to energetically and flawlessly pitch your show. Executives listen to like 9 pitches a day. So if you're not selling your show with 110% enthusiasm, they're gonna pass right over you. So you have to practice your pitch like your paycheck depends on it. Me and the showrunner I worked with, Ethan Banville, practiced our pitch so many times. We practiced in front of a mirror, to our family members. We filmed ourselves practicing, and then watched the footage, gave each other notes, and then burned the evidence. We memorized our whole Bible, but despite everything, the first time we pitched, I was still nervous. I had no idea what pitching a show would be like. We brought in our stapled Bible that we typed out on Microsoft Word, and I thought, this isn't enough. This Bible doesn't even have a spine. I still thought we needed to bring in finished scripts and character designs to show the executives how much thought we put into the show. But Ethan reassured me, No, no. The executives don't want to be overwhelmed with content. But when we got to the lobby, I saw the group ahead of us pitching their show, and they had cardboard cutouts of their characters, and they were handing the executives custom plushies, and I turned to Ethan, "We are so underprepared." When we got inside, we pitched the show just like we practiced 1,000 times, and then the executive told me that no studio would ever want to work with a YouTuber. Yeah, sometimes they don't even wait to tell you in an email that they're going to pass. Sometimes they just get it over with right then and there. So, you know, not the best confidence boost for your first pitch. But we kept on pitching, and we kept hearing a lot of no's. And if you ever pitch, get ready to hear that response. Everyone in Hollywood has a story of being turned down by everyone, and then finding the right home for their idea. And sometimes really talented people work for years on an idea, and it goes nowhere. So the fact that I was even able to make something and it didn't get canceled, I'm incredibly grateful for. But getting a show greenlit is not the only way to get it made. You can always put in the work and develop something yourself. No, you won't have a network backing you with tons of money, but if you truly believe in your idea, you should at least put something out for the world to see and over time build your own audience and then, who knows, maybe even sell it to a network. But not the one who said they never work with a YouTuber. They're horrible. Okay. That's all the time I got. I gotta get back to watching Oddball streaming October 7th on my Netflix.
I think that everyone at some point in their life should work in a fast food or retail job. Not to improve their work ethic or anything, but so that everyone knows what it's like to have that kind of job. They wouldn't work in fast food their whole lives, maybe just like for 6 months, just so they get a feel for it. So with that, let's talk about the time when I worked in fast food. I used to work at a very small local sandwich shop. I don't know if any of you guys heard of it. It's called Subway. Our spokesperson was in the news recently. I don't know if you guys look at the news. Did you hear he got beat up in jail? I kind of want to meet the person who beat up Jared more than Jared. Not in person. We wouldn't meet in person, obviously. But, like, he would be behind bars, and I would just look at the guy who beat up my spokesperson. How many people get to say that they beat up a fast food icon who is also a pedophile? Only one, and it's that guy. Okay, but seriously, guys, working at Subway was probably one of the most easiest jobs out there. I don't know why I'm about to complain about it to you guys. We got free cookies. And you know the comic with the Subways in Hell? I was actually working at Subway when I made that comic. I just think it adds sort of a little bit of value to it. You see, the owners, who are husband and wife, can you believe it, of the Subway I worked at owned 2 stores. One of the Subway stores was in a Walmart on an Indian reservation, because we have those in Arizona, and the other Subway was the Subway I worked at. And since the Walmart store was always busy, the owners would spend 99% of their time at that store. So I didn't really have a boss most of the time. On the off chance the owners did show up, they would just pick up some food and then they would make sure I was making sandwiches the right way. And every time I made a sandwich in front of them, they would always find something wrong with it, without fail. You put on too many olives. Do you know according to the Subway formula, you're only supposed to put on 8 olives on a foot long? 8! One for every other bite. That's just ridiculous. Can you imagine someone just counting out 8 olives? Nobody does that. I usually worked the closing shift, and at the end of the night, we would turn the alarm and we'd have 60 seconds to get out of the store. But one time I had the opening shift, so I unlocked the door to get in with my key, and the alarm went beep, beep, meaning I had 60 seconds to turn it off. No big deal, right? I've turned the alarm on all the time when I was closing. So I go to the little control panel, and I type in the code, and nothing happens. The beeping is still there, and the clock is still ticking down. So I go, okay, I'm going to press each button very carefully. I'm going to make sure each button makes a beep when I press it. Beep, beep, beep. Nothing still happens. So I go, okay, I'm going to make sure to press each button very carefully. And I start thinking, did they change the passcode without telling me? Well, this is the only passcode I know, so we're just going to try it again. And I press each button very carefully. Beep. 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 And it goes quiet. And then the alarm goes off. I still had like 20 seconds left. But I guess when you get it wrong 3 times, it automatically assumes you're a burglar. So while the alarm is going off, I look on the contact sheet for the owner's cell phone number. I step outside, I call him, and he doesn't pick up. So I go back inside, find the number for the other Subway store. They open an hour before we do. Someone picks up with their stupid voice. Oh, thank you for calling Subway. I'm blah, 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 blah. How may I help you? And I go, hey, is Mike there? That's not his real name, guys. Don't worry. And they go, just a minute. Yeah, sure. I have all the time in the world. The cops might be on their way, but take your time. So,
Mike picks up.
Yellow. Hey, Mike, this is James. What's the passcode for the alarm?
Who is this?
It's James. What's the passcode?
What are you doing there, James?
Why aren't you answering the question?
I have the opening shift.
Is the alarm going off?
Yeah, no one told me the new code.
Yeah, we changed it. It's the last four digits of your social security number.
Oh, okay, thanks, Mike.
I don't know my social security number.
So I finally get the alarm off.
No one showed up,
thankfully. Which I actually don't know if that's a good thing or not, now that I say it out loud.
We did have a store manager who would, like, make the schedule and sometimes tell us, hey, can you guys do a better job at your job?
But other than that, she was cool. She watches my videos, and so do her little brothers. They're big fans. Shout out to Ivan and Andy. Those are the brothers.
So get this. At Subway, you only work with one other person. Just you and them in an empty Subway for 5 hours.
I mean, we weren't, like, empty all the time.
Okay.
And when you're not making sandwiches, you have other stuff to do, like stocking the chips, or we had stuff to do. But okay, we did watch a lot of Netflix and do homework, so I mean, it was
that other person you worked with would make or break your entire shift.
It wasn't the annoying customers. I kind of got used to annoying customers.
So I worked with a lot of crappy people. And I also worked with a lot of people who I would probably never become friends with except in a work setting.
You see, you gotta understand the type of people who got jobs at Subway.
Potheads. Most of them are potheads.
And some of them are really cool. I'm just going to go over a couple of the characters that I worked with. There was Tyler. I freaking love this guy. He smoked a lot of weed. He actually taught me what vaping was, and he got me into Clash of Clans. I actually mentioned him and his girlfriend in my riddles video. I don't know if I ever told him that. And of course, I have to mention Corey. He was cool. We watched How to Get Away with Murder on Netflix, and I've also hung out with him outside of work. What him and Tyler had in common is that they would actually do their job, which you gotta appreciate. Then there was this guy. Get this, who was also named Jared. He loved Marvel, and that's like the only thing he would talk about. I can say these things. He doesn't watch my videos.
There was Sarah. She was cool. She made me a bread bowl. And her boyfriend, Jay. He talked about chakras and third eyes. He was interesting.
And also, there's Anthony. He's cool. What's up, Anthony? For the 100,000 sprinkles video, I actually went back to Subway to use their scale because I knew they had one. And we counted 500 sprinkles again just to be more accurate for the 100,000. And Anthony helped me count. Instead of working. I mean, at least he got paid minimum wage for it. So two more stories before I go. One time, Jared asked me to take out this pile of trash, and I was like, oh, okay, I'll just put this pile of trash in the dumpster. And as I was taking it out, I saw that there was a chip poster in the pile, and I thought, this is too cool to throw away. I'm gonna keep it. So I took it home with me, and then the next day when I went in, people were saying, oh, where's the chip poster? We can't find the chip poster. We haven't seen it anywhere. And I'm thinking, I have the poster. I decided not to tell anyone that I had the poster, and it's still hanging up in my room.
Sorry, boss, if you're finding out about this now.
Okay, and then the other story. I was working with a manager, and we were just making sandwiches like usual. And I noticed that when we toasted a sandwich, it would burn the paper a little on the edges. That probably shouldn't be happening. So then a customer asks for just bacon toasted. And the boss lady puts some bacon on paper, and then puts it in the toaster. And we don't have a setting for just bacon. So then when she opens the toaster, there was a fire on the bacon. So then she starts to whack it with the little metal tray thing, but all she ended up doing was fanning the flames, making the fire bigger. You got this, right? Then I went in the back and I got the fire extinguisher and I actually used it. I single-handedly saved that Subway.
Wait, what have I done?
Is it okay if the bacon's a little crispy and has nitrogen and carbon dioxide stuff on it?
Do you guys remember Jay from the Subway videos? I basically said he believed in zodiac signs and chakras and third eyes. See, I'm someone who doesn't really believe in that sort of stuff. Oh, hey, Black Zen.
Hey, James.
So Jay was trying to teach me about energies and vibrations, and he told me about this YouTube channel called Infinite Waters, parentheses, Diving Deep. Now on this channel, you will see videos like What I Eat in a Day as a Vegan, How to Stop Burning Bridges with People, 7 Amazing Tips That Will Turn You into a Self-Loving Whiz. But he also has videos like How to Open Your Third Eye. So I don't necessarily agree with everything he says on his videos, but I really like him and you should check him out. And the creator of these videos, named Ralph, I just love how he starts off every single video. He goes, peace, infinite waters, diving deep once again. Can I get a hello there? And it is super peaceful and I recommend it. And on a lot of his videos, he talks about doing a
7-day vegan challenge. 7-day vegan challenge. 7-day vegan challenge. 7-day vegan challenge.
You know, for the amount of times you bring up
the 7-day vegan challenge,
you'd think it would solve all your problems, which is why I, James, have decided to partake in the 7-day vegan challenge. But I'm going to call it the 7-day vegan challenge, baby. Solves all your problems. Can't get enough sleep? 7-day vegan challenge, baby. Can't find your car keys? 7-day vegan challenge, baby. People keep interrupting you? You wanna die? 7-day vegan challenge, baby. All these lame-o pleb YouTubers doing these lame-o pleb challenges, like, why does this exist? While they're doing this, I'm actually going out of my way to suffer for a whole week for views. I did some research into what was vegan, and apparently Reese's Puffs and Oreos are vegan.
Well, this is gonna be super easy.
As of recording this, I have already completed the 7-day vegan challenge, and I've kinda delayed making this video because being a vegan has changed me. So while I was doing the 7-day vegan challenge, I wrote this log after each day. I'm not gonna read all of it, just the first and last day of the challenge, because days 2 through 6 can pretty much be summed up in... So this is what I wrote at the end of day 1. My rations are already very low. I was not prepared for this. I'm the kind of person that will snack on Cheez-Its and trail mix throughout the day. But now I can't do that. Because I have to think of the freaking animals. Every time I'm around food, I just have to keep screaming, vegan, vegan, in my mind so I won't unconsciously take a handful of Cheez-Its. I went shopping for food today, and everything I wasn't allowed to eat looked super good. I was even craving the food that I've never bought before, like Hot Pockets. Who likes Hot Pockets? I accidentally bought bread that contained honey, which I don't know if that's vegan or not. If we've learned anything from the bee movie is that bees have no purpose if they're not making honey. I'm in for a long week. I'm already fantasizing about what I'll eat as soon as the challenge is over. I'm thinking of 4x4 from In-N-Out. I'll try to write tomorrow. And then after that long week was over, this is what I wrote for day 7. In a few hours, all my problems will be fixed, and I will be an immortal being. But I'm gonna throw that all away because tomorrow I'm gonna drink milk again. I've completed the vegan challenge, but I don't feel that accomplished. The best way I can think to describe what I'm feeling is... oh, it's over. I remember when I started the challenge, I was thinking about all the food I was going to eat once I was done, but now I'm just not craving anything. Still, though, I'm probably never going to do this again. While I was doing the challenge, I went to Sprouts and bought microwavable veggie burgers, and when I cooked them up, they smelled like throw-up. So see if you can tell how much I was trying to hold back throwing up in this video.
So today, we were going to try these veggie burgers, and as I was cooking it, it sort of smelled like throw-up. That almost made me throw up. So we have the burgers and tomatoes and lettuce. Oh, okay. I'm really hungry right now. Here's a veggie burger. We're gonna try this. We're gonna try and eat this. Hopefully, it, you know, tastes better than it smells.
By the way, that was vegan cheese in the video. I didn't just put normal cheese on the veggie burger, guys. Okay, I'm not a heartless creature. I care about cows. You know, the internet really loves to just hate on vegans. But I don't think it's as bad as the internet makes it out to be. Of course, there will always be jerks in any group of people. And you shouldn't think that you're better than someone else just because of what you eat. Also, I want to mention that while I did the vegan challenge, I would lose my breath just by going up the stairs. Some vegans would probably say that I was malnourished. And I probably was. This video is probably going to get some downvotes from some angry vegans, even though I'm about to compliment them. I think it takes a lot of self-control to do what vegans do. I don't know why anyone would purposely do that. I admire anyone that puts so much care and thought into their diet. I mean, ever since the challenge was finished, I've been trying to eat healthier, and I don't want to brag or anything, but I bought whole wheat waffles the other day, so I can feel my bones getting stronger. So, in conclusion... unfortunately, the 7-day vegan challenge, baby, solves all your problems. Did not solve all my problems. But even if it did solve all my problems, I still probably wouldn't be vegan. I would still drink milk. You know, because that's what makes ice cream and cheese and nachos. You think I'm exaggerating, but no, you would have to pay me a very pretty penny to get me to be full vegan. Like, no joke, a minimum of $1 billion. Am I glad I did the 7-day vegan challenge? Yes, I am.
Then we got some organic pancake syrup. I think pancake syrup itself is organic too, but we're just going to eat it again. Look, where does it say it? Non-GMO. non-GMO. I haven't had a GMO in days.
Draw a picture right now. All right, you done? That sucks, right? I spent 2 hours on the face, I couldn't get the hands right, and when I compared my art to this other artist I found online who's younger than me, it makes me want to curb stomp this monstrosity so no one ever has to look at it again. Okay, now, think of a joke. Not one you've already heard before. I want you to think up a brand new, never been done before joke. Okay. You know how cats are, like, lazy? Maybe we could do a joke about a lazy cat and his owner is like, "Ah, stop being so lazy." That sucked too! Now imagine doing both of those things together and then putting that artwork up for the entire world to leave their unfiltered, anonymous opinions. And on top of that, you also make virtually no money off of it. Who in their right mind would put themselves through that kind of torture? Well, dear viewer, I would like you all to meet Zachary. Zachary is a webcomic artist. He makes webcomics just so when you're scrolling through your timeline while taking your morning poo, you get a little chuckle to yourself. And then you keep on scrolling, forgetting about his existence entirely in mere seconds. I have a soft spot for funny webcomics. Not the super serious superhero ones or the Japanese ones. Wait, why is this part all pixely? Webcomics can be shared on any platform. In fact, a lot of webcomics get reposted without the artist's consent and with their names removed. Which is kind of weird that someone went through the effort of removing a watermark when they could have just, you know, not done anything and left it. I hope you all realize that behind every comic is an artist who just wanted to make you laugh and doodle something that day. I started reading webcomics at a very young age. Back then, we just called them comics. They were really the only books that I liked to read, and the only place you could read the hottest new comics was in the newspaper. Oh, sorry, I should clarify. A newspaper is a stack of gray paper that would be delivered to your house by a child riding a bike, and they would print 19 pages of useless information and have one page dedicated to the funnies. This is where the classics were born. You know the ones. The Calvin and Hobbes. The Garfields. The Far Sides. Some of these comics have made me laugh harder than any meme ever has. I just want to say that Calvin and Hobbes was an extremely creative comic. It was a comic about a rambunctious boy that had a giant predatory animal best friend. I mean, where else have you seen that before? By the way, if you ever see those Calvin peeing bumper stickers, those are unlicensed knockoffs and really go against everything Calvin and his creator, Bill Watterson, stood for. In fact, all Calvin and Hobbes merchandise is unlicensed because Bill Watterson never made merchandise. But I mean, aren't these Crochet Hobbes dolls the coolest? So there was only enough space in the paper for about 20 comics. And last time I counted, there were way more than 20 comic creators. So if you wanted to get your silly little comic in the newspaper, you had some fierce competition. But now, anyone with a computer and enough dedication can create comics that get shared by millions of people. You don't even need a fancy drawing tablet or expensive painting software, or even art skills in general. Webcomics and the internet and memes have been intertwined for decades. Many of your favorite meme formats are just edited webcomics. Now, in most cases, if someone took an artist's work, defaced it, and then re-uploaded it without credit, that'd be a bad thing. But memes are different, I guess. The reason I'm bringing this up is because I want you all to know that these artists have made other comics that are just as funny, and you should support their work and buy their books, and if you're going to make a webcomic edit, please just keep in the watermark. It's literally more work to take it out, and you're being an asshole. Some of you original gangsters may remember that I also used to be a webcomic artist. I posted my first webcomic in 2012, which was over 10 years. 10 years?! It's been that long? What the fuck? I'll be honest, my webcomics took a little while to get some traction. Let me explain something. All the comics I would read in the newspaper had distinguished characters with personalities. A lot of times, the punchline of a newspaper comic would only be funny because we knew the characters and their mannerisms. Garfield hates Mondays, so instead of him hating Friday the 13th, he hates Monday the 13th. That's a good one, Garfield. So I try to make a webcomic like that with my own little universe. I'm gonna be a little vulnerable for a minute. Let's talk about my OCs I made when I was a 16-year-old boy. There were three main brothers. Jake, who was a self-insert character, one time I dressed up as him for Halloween. Justin, the book-smart straight man. Straight man as in the character archetype, not the sexuality. Although if any of the brothers were gay, Justin would be the gay one. And Kevin, the laid-back older brother who did whatever he wanted because he's the oldest. Those three were the main boys. Jake, Justin, and Kevin. The three whitest names anyone's ever heard. Now, if you're an up-and-coming comedy webcomic artist, I would suggest to not to do what I did. If you're just trying to make someone laugh, you don't need a whole cast of characters that have intricate relationships. Just tell your joke and leave. Or don't. It's your art, you can do whatever you want. Eventually, I wanted to rebrand myself. Instead of having distinguished, defined characters, I went with a very basic-looking character design that had absolutely no distinguishing features at all. And I settled on a design that looked like this. I mean, over time, I refined it. I originally posted my comics exclusively to Tumblr. It was just me and this other obscure webcomic about trolls. We were the two main ones, really. Now, if you're still an up-and-coming webcomic artist, then you should post your comics to every platform imaginable. I learned the importance of cross-platform promotion the not-so-easy way. One day, I got a Tumblr message from someone asking if they could post my comics to a small, unknown app called iFunny. And I said, sure. Then that guy would periodically send me messages like, dude, we are blowing up! Our comics keep getting featured! And I was like, our? Then I wake up to messages asking, hey, are you the one posting these to iFunny? And I said, no, but I gave the other guy permission to. You know he's impersonating you and starting beef with other artists, right? Hmm? It turned out that iFunny was my most popular social media account, and I didn't even have access to it. I eventually got the account back, and now people tell me that they loved reading my comics on iFunny back in the day, which wasn't even part of the plan originally. Webcomics have really impacted me and this channel. Some of my earliest online friends were other webcomic artists who I don't keep in touch with as much as I should. My bad, guys, I'm sorry. My username is based off my webcomic, my character design was made for my webcomic, and even my Cannonball profile picture is from a panel in my webcomic. I really hope this video makes you appreciate the webcomics that you see on your timeline. I know you see them, they're everywhere. If you come across a comic you like, I want you to try and find the original artist's socials and browse their other comics they've created. I guarantee you'll find some banger comics that just didn't get the same amount of attention as the other ones. And who knows, you might just make a difference in someone's art career. You know, making a whole video about webcomics has made me miss my first love. A lot of times when I think of a joke, I have to wait 2 months to tell it, and at that point, I don't even know if it's funny anymore. But a webcomic can have same-day joke delivery. So this is how I'm officially announcing that I'm making webcomics again. I'll be posting them on my website and maybe Twitter if I'm still verified. There's already 6 brand new comics. Feel free to make any meme edits of them. I don't care. Also, be sure to check out this amazing reversible toasty plush. It's honestly my favorite thing. And up until April 10th, we're running Merch Madness, where you can possibly score a free VidCon ticket and meet up with me. You don't even need to buy anything to enter, so check out the description for more information. I'm super excited to be making comics again. It's how I started out my internet journey. I'm going to try and post at least 1 comic a week, so be on the lookout for those. Thank you all for watching and sticking through this end card. Y'all are the real ones.
And action.
So, Mr. James,
is it rolling?
Yes.
And action.
So, Mr. James, is it true that you wrote a book?
Oh, that thing? Yes, the rumors are true. One afternoon, I was just thinking to myself, why aren't I a published author yet? So I just jotted down some notes and doodles, and then I thought, you know, people should pay money for this.
So, like, it's just a bunch of pictures?
No, I added words, too. It's a collection of stories and opinions of mine, some of which I've already made into videos, and some that are completely original new stories. Like, one chapter is all about the science fair, and yeah, it is the same story I used in the YouTube video, but I also go more in depth with the story, and I draw new pictures.
YouTubers have a reputation of writing bad books. Does this concern you?
Oh, bad books, huh? I'll have you know that my book was the number one best-selling book in literature, criticism, and theory. Do I know what that means? No. But did I beat Tyrant, Shakespeare on Politics? Yes. Does that mean I'm better than William Shakespeare himself? I'll let you be the judge when you pick up your copy of the book, link in the description.
I'll give you a clue. The answer is yes.
Are all authors as condescending as you?
Do you even know what that word means?
James, is there anything special that happens to people who order at VidCon?
Yeah, the people who pre-order at VidCon get a signed copy.
Well, what about people who aren't going to VidCon?
Sucks to be them.
Cut, come on.
Haha, that was a good joke. So I actually am going to be selling signed copies. I'll be signing the first 1,000 copies to people who pre-order the book on my website. Check the link in the description. Also, speaking of my site, I've revamped the whole thing and got a bunch of new merchandise. Check it out if you have some free time. Christmas is right around the corner, guys. There's also non-signed copies available if you just want to pre-order it regularly. Or you can wait until August when the book comes out and buy it at Barnes & Noble or your local bookstore. And depending on how well these signed copies sell, I'll release more. We'll see. If you're interested, then I'll update everything on Twitter, so follow me on Twitter to be updated. Anyway, authors sure can be stuck up sometimes. Like this one time when this pretty well-established author was coming to my town and was doing a signing. I say well-established, but I'm sure if I said his name, you guys wouldn't actually know who he is. Anyway, at his signing, he gave an hour-long talk, and he said he wasn't going to do a Q&A segment because he said he'd been an author for so long that he felt that he already answered every question ever. Okay, Mr. Yahoo Answers, sorry our questions bothered you so much. And then after you listen to him talk, you gotta go up to meet him to get a book signed, but he was the most stereotypical, I'm too good for you celebrity I've ever seen. When you got to his table, he didn't say anything to you, and if you wanted a picture, he wouldn't even look up at the camera. So my family has this picture of all of us standing and smiling next to this guy, just looking down, reading a book. So I will follow in that author's footsteps and only take pictures with fans while signing my book and looking like this. Contrast to that when I met Stephen Pastis. Pastis? I should have looked up how to say it. He's the creator of a comic strip called Pearls Before Swine, and all you need to know is that his comics are in the newspaper and he's really great. He came to visit Arizona and I was 15 at the time, so I was making stick figure comics, and I wanted to impress Stephen, so I got out my ruler and protractor and I very carefully drew this comic. How was your run?
Well, let's just say Justin is all pooped out.
What happened? I don't want to talk about it.
Get it? He pooped his pants. This isn't based off anything in real life, okay? I was 15. Shut up.
I went to his book signing. He was really awesome. I showed him my comic. He laughed and he told me to keep going. And now I'm a YouTuber.
I mean, it wasn't just what he said that got me into doing comics and YouTube. I wanted to do that way before I met him.
Anyway, he was nice. Ironically enough, I was never a fan of reading, and I think a big part of it was that teachers forced you to read books you didn't want to read. So if this book becomes the next Romeo and Juliet or Grapes of Wrath, and teachers make their students write book reports on this book, then I'll make it easy for all of you. In the description of this video, I will create an already completed book report for this book. Now, I know what some of you are thinking.
James, won't the teachers know if all the book reports are the same?
Yes, they will, which is why I added some blank spaces for you to put in your own words. It's sort of like a Mad Lib that you turn in for homework.
And this book report doesn't even have to be on my book. You can use it for any book.
So if you have a book report due tomorrow, then check the link in the description. Trust me, you'll get at least an 80%. You know, the people who already pre-ordered this book are pretty ballsy. They don't even know what this book's about. For all they know, it could have just been a single picture of me laughing at all the money they gave me. But it's not that. I promise. That's just the inside sleeve. And that's the end of the video, everyone. I'll see you at VidCon.
Juan Ponce de Leon was famously known for searching for the legendary Fountain of Youth with his crew in the 1500s. Spoiler alert, he didn't find it, obviously, because he's dead, I think. But his search might have been successful if only he lived in the 21st century. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm here to tell you that we have the key to immortality right in our grocery stores. And it all starts with this tiny red bottle of 5-hour energy. So drinking one of these gives you 5 hours of energy. So that means drinking 2 will give you 10 hours, right? It takes 17,520,000 hours to make up 2,000 years. And here's how we unlock our immortality. To get 17 million hours of energy, we would have to drink 3,504,000 bottles of 5-hour energy. After you do all that, you have enough energy to last the next 2,000 years. And there you go, that's how you live forever. Every 2,000 years, you just drink 3 million bottles of 5-hour energy, And what, that's 12 ounces a bottle divided by 128. So that's only 328,500 gallons of 5-hour energy, and boom. So it's not really a fountain of youth, it's more of a pond of youth. And you have to drink all that 5-hour energy every 2,000 years. It's not going to be forever. And it might take a while, so just set aside like an afternoon and just get sipping. Wait, hold on. If each bottle is $250, then how much would it cost? $8.7 million? Dang it! Only the rich get to live forever! Okay, guys, never mind. I guess immortality is impossible. Ugh, just looks like all of us are going to have to die.
Hey, kids, do you want some candy?
Yeah!
No, kids! Never accept candy from strangers! Don't you know candy can cause cavities? Next time a stranger offers you candy, just think about all the cavities you'd get.
This message brought to you by the Dentists of America Association.
You've all heard the phrase, stranger danger, right? Probably a parent slash guardian taught you that you should never trust strangers. And that's really solid advice because you're just a dumb kid who doesn't know what a pedophile is. But all those parents slash guardians grew up without the internet. And, the internet is full of strangers. And I'm one of them. How much do you really know about me?
I'm a math education major. I want to be a math teacher.
Is that I used to have a speech impediment when I was little.
Think it was the Halloween after the bunny?
And that's why I'm a furry.
I, James, was a bedwetter until I was 8 years old.
Okay, granted, you do know quite a few personal details. The internet changes how we talk to people, meaning it's a lot easier to talk to strangers on the internet than in real life, because on the internet, you can find strangers who have the same interests, hobbies, and fetishes as you do. But I find it so hard to talk to new people. I would never have enough confidence to be a door-to-door salesman. There are some jobs where you have to deal with annoying customers, but being a door-to-door salesman, you're the annoying one. I guess I just hate bothering people. I'd be a terrible salesman.
What?
Do you have a water filter?
Yeah.
But I was just thinking that I could use another one.
Oh, then you probably don't need this. I'm sorry for wasting your time.
One time I actually did have to be a door-to-door salesman for a Boy Scout activity. But I wasn't even selling anything. I was just telling people about a canned food drive the Scouts were doing. As a troop, it was our job to go door-to-door and ask people if there was any non-perishable food that they were willing to donate. Being a nervous little kid probably benefited me, because most people were super nice, and a lot of people donated stuff. And even the people who didn't donate were like, oh, sorry, I don't have anything on me.
You don't have any canned foods?
Well, dude, that's perfect. The house next door just gave me some. Here, these are for you. But there were two houses I went to that I still remember to this day. One guy pointed to his no soliciting sign and asked me if I knew what it said.
Yeah, I know what soliciting is.
I'd always thought that soliciting meant I couldn't sell you something, not that I couldn't ask you for free food. And at the other house, all the guy said was, listen, I'm not interested. And then both houses slammed the door in my face. Some of you are probably thinking, that's it? That was nothing. And yeah, looking back at the situation, I got off pretty easily. People who are a full-time door-to-door salesman probably have to deal with way worse stuff every day. But to a fragile-minded kid who was just doing what his scoutmaster told him to do, those experiences scarred me. Luckily, I'm not a salesman, so I'm usually the person on the other side of the door. I never know what to say to these people. For the longest time, I used to tell them the exact same thing. My mom's not home. But one day, that's not going to work. So for now, I just have to pretend that I'm interested, tell them I'll give them a call, and then put their pamphlet into the pile. My grandma, however, would, treat these door-to-door salesmen very differently. You see, my grandma is known as the nicest person on the planet, so she would invite these salesmen inside, offer them a glass of water, and then show them pictures of her grandkids. I'm not exaggerating. One time I was at my grandgram's house just playing some video games, and this person, an adult person I'd never seen before, just started watching me play. Are you one of my cousins? And then my grandma handed him a big cup of water filled with ice and a straw. They talked for a bit. He left, and I asked, Gram, who was that?
Oh, it was someone just trying to sell me a vacuum cleaner.
But salesmen don't have it the hardest on the doorstep. There's also Jehovah's Witnesses and Mormon missionaries who are literally trying to save your soul. I can't even get mad at these people because if you had the secret to eternal happiness, wouldn't you be telling everyone in your neighborhood too? They're trying to do good and all, but whenever they show up, hello, do you have time for
to be baptized?
Oh, sorry guys, but you're wasting your time. You see, I'm an YouTuber, so I'm not going to heaven.
Here's a story that's a prime example of me failing at talking to people. I had just finished grocery shopping at Walmart, and this isn't important to the story, but Adam from Something Else YT was there.
Hello. Walmart's where I make friends.
I was walking to my car, and I started eating an Uncrustable frozen PB&J sandwich that I bought, and this guy drives up to me and yells, "Man, you're not even waiting to get in the car. You're just eating that thing up."
Yeah, I was hungry.
Then he pulls his car over and says, "All right, listen, fellas, I'm traveling to Buckeye, and I need $8 for gas, but I forgot my wallet at home." And I thought, huh, that's coincidentally how much a pack of cigarettes costs. He offered us his CDs in exchange for $8, but Adam said the smart thing.
Sorry, man, I don't got any cash on me.
And he showed the man his empty wallet. Poor. All I have is a 10.
You stupid mother...
I don't know why I said that. I think I was actually going to pay this man $8 if I had exact change. But here's the thing. I didn't only have a 10. I also had a 20. The guy saw my cash and said, "Man, all you have is a 10. Nah, man, I see you have a 20. And then he raised the price of his CDs from $8 to $30. Like I said, I should have handled the situation differently. If I was going to give him money, I should have given him a 10 and said, "Now give me $2 back." But he had a solid argument. He said, "If there were 20 dudes who all tried to jump you, I'd have your back." Now that's not a bad price for a Walmart parking lot bodyguard. You know, man, you gotta realize that money is just an object. Okay, then why do you want it? He asked us, "Do you boys like rap music?" He does.
Hey, I do. I listen to like Eminem, Kendrick Lamar, and Chance the Rap. Oh, no.
And then the man pulled out his CDs, but he didn't have a CD player in his car, so he asked me if I could use my CD player, and I said, sure, but my CD player already had my mixtape in that I never bothered to take out, so when I turned on my CD player... Oh, I got something in my throat. By the way, if you want to listen to my whole mixtape, link in the description. Adam and I started listening to his CDs, and the man started doing this. Yeah, that's the good stuff. So what'll it be, little man? You gonna give me the money or not, huh? Huh? Do I need to get my gang of 19 other dudes out? Huh? Yeah, I ended up giving the guy my $30. Honestly, I didn't get the meth head drug user vibe from him. He was more of a goofy dad who just needed $30. And after I gave him the money, he thanked us, saying things like, "God bless you," and talked about how much he was going to miss his CD. Now, was I scammed out of $30 and secretly this guy is laughing to himself that he sold a used rap CD to a white boy? Yeah, that definitely could be a possibility, but I hope whoever this guy is, that he pays the good deed forward. And I hope you made it to wherever you need to be. In conclusion, never carry cash on your kids.
I like to think that my videos, for the most part, have greatly improved in quality from the past year. Let's watch a clip of my first video. Roll the clip.
So you know those books you make in elementary school that you write as a class? And some publishing company makes them into a real book.
So you know those books you make in elementary school? Man, I don't think I could sound less insecure. And I was 18 when I made that video. I was legally old enough to... get married. So I'm always trying to improve the quality of my videos. I've gotten a better microphone, I've learned to level out my audio, I like to think my drawings are more lively and move more, but sometimes when I record, I tend to... smack my lips. And I always thought it was because my mouth was dry. So then I would chug an entire water bottle, but I would still sometimes have smacky lips. So I thought, is it possible I could be drinking too much water? Is that even a thing? Maybe I should drink Gatorade. So no big deal, right? First I Google, how to stop lip smacking. And since I couldn't find anything that had pictures...
How can you read this? There's no pictures.
I decided to ask YouTube instead. I don't know, maybe someone out there makes voice acting tutorials. But instead, I stumbled upon something indescribable.
Tonight is the return of the beloved lip smacking.
So there was this about 14-year-old girl just getting real close to the microphone and smacking her lips. And apparently there's a lot higher demand for people who smack their lips than people who don't. Jeez, I don't even know why I tried to fix that problem. But you're probably thinking, James, this is just one video, right? This is just one person making a YouTube video, right? There's not like an entire community dedicated to...
Autonomous Sensory Meridian Response, ASMR.
This is the entire Wikipedia page printed out with notes. You know, I bet at least some people watching this already know what it is. And you didn't tell me about it. What, did you think I wasn't going to find out?
And my college charges 5 cents to print a page. So I spent 65 cents printing out this Wikipedia article. Money I'm never getting back. So what is ASMR? Basically, it's a video of someone whispering into a microphone and making certain sounds for about 20 to 60 minutes. Now you might be thinking, why? Why do they do this? The Wikipedia article says that the purpose of ASMR is to give listeners sort of a tingly sensation in the head, and some people describe it as akin to a mild electric current. The best way I can think to describe it is, you know those Bob Ross videos? Remember how you just loved to watch them even though you couldn't paint? Why did you watch them? Yeah, you watched him because you loved his soft, gentle voice and the sounds of the paintbrush on the canvas. And then when he beat his paintbrush on that little thing, you can beat me, Bobby. I think that's what ASMR is trying to create. It's basically supposed to give you the same feeling when you watch a Bob Ross video.
Man, you're watching those videos a lot differently than me.
Now, since I read the Wikipedia page, let me tell you some useless facts about it. The first case of ASMR was in a book written in 1925 that said, "With a roughness in her voice like a grasshopper, which rasped his spine deliciously and sent running up into his brain waves of sound." The frick? In this part about evolutionary history, David Hurin states that the ASMR effect is clearly strongly related to the perception of non-threat and altruistic. Faith, what is this word?
Altruistic?
Altruistic. The ASMR effect is clearly strongly related to the perception of non-threat and altruistic attention, and has strong similarities to physical grooming in primates, who derive enormous pleasure, borderlining on euphoria, when being groomed by a grooming partner, not to get clean, but rather to bond with each other. So that begs the question, do dogs like it? ASMR was officially created in 2008, but it didn't get popular until a Facebook group along with a subreddit was created in 2010. Now, it wasn't always called ASMR. Instead, people used phrases like brain massage, head tingle, brain tingle, spine tingle, and my personal favorite, attention-induced head orgasm. What are you doing with those grasshoppers, ma'am? But a lot of people didn't want to use orgasm in the name, because then people would think that this ASMR stuff is pretty sexual, which it totally isn't, you guys, except in 2015 when people started making a new genre of ASMR videos called ASMR-otica. And something else that's worth noting on the Wikipedia page, the popularity of ASMR videos featuring women does substantially exceed those created by male performers. However, there are some popular male ASMRists, and not all video creators are heterosexual. So can I not make ASMR videos? Is that what it's saying? So the creator of the Facebook group back in 2010 coined the term autonomous sensory meridian response. Autonomous meaning that it's spontaneous, sensory meaning the senses or sensation, and meridian meaning orgasm. I'm not making that up. Now, the word meridian doesn't mean orgasm at all. But in the Wikipedia article, it says, Alan chose the word meridian, mistakenly believing that it was a kinder way of saying orgasmic. Look, it's even on our blog. So you're telling me this whole time, people have been using ASMR to mean climax, and that's not even what it means. Okay, some other things in the Wikipedia article I want to talk about is that apparently not everyone experiences ASMR. There's also a type of ASMR called binaural recording, where performers use two microphones and place them where your ears would be. So it's extra creepy. Another popular... Look, I'm lip smacking right now. Another popular theme is that these videos do a lot of role-playing, specifically clinical role-playing. Now, I'm someone who never really got into the whole role-playing experience, except when Captain Sparkles does it. Come on, where's part five? Let's read the wiki! The ASMRists provide clinical or medical services, including routine general medical examinations. The creator of these videos make no claim to the reality of what is depicted, and the viewer is intended to be aware that they are watching and listening to a simulation, performed by an actor. Yeah, I don't think we can really use the word actor, Wikipedia. Okay, what else? There's little scientific work done on it. Some people say that it's great for fighting insomnia and anxiety, but others say, no, it's not. But I mean, it's not like it's bad for you. And there has been one song made to trigger ASMR, but I listened to it, I don't think song is the best word for it. It's more just normal ASMR audio. Just because it was released on an album doesn't make it a song, Wikipedia. And there's one comment on this video that I think sums up ASMR pretty well.
I'm extremely uncomfortable.
I had no idea that ASMR was even a thing. Did you know it was a thing? I didn't. Heck, even College Humor made a parody ASMR video. I just want to make things clear. I'm not hating on people who make ASMR videos or even people who like to watch it. And I'm certainly not jealous that some of these people have hundreds of thousands of subscribers and millions of views and all they're doing is just brushing a microphone for 20 minutes. But guys, I think this ASMR thing is getting a little out of hand. Keep in mind that all these videos are about 15 minutes to an hour long. We have this girl with a southern accent singing I'm Blue and Numa Numa to remove a curse from you.
Numa Numa Numa, yay, I'm blue, dubba ding dubba da.
Inaudible whispering and tongue clicking, a couple of dentist roleplays, a library book return roleplay, eating Chinese food, a couple of Yu-Gi-Oh card readings, a Minecraft let's play, a Five Nights at Freddy's tribute, Undertale, a Mario Maker let's play, evening with a vampire, the Joker, Satan, alien abduction for men, and torture roleplay. Really? You could type ASMR and then type anything after that and you'll get something.
You think God stays in heaven because he too lives in fear of what he's created?
And what's doubly weird is that all of these videos are recent. Like, they were made in 2015 or even 2016. Well, obviously Undertale and Mario Maker are recent. But Shrek? Shrek?
Shrek.
But just to finish things up, I just want to get something off my chest. This Undertale ASMR was pretty good. Compared to the other ones. You still might be thinking, that's pretty weird, James. Yeah, it is pretty weird. We've gotten pretty deep in the weirdness with those alien ones. And they have almost 1 million views. I just think this one deserves more views. You know, I just want one ASMR video to be like 40 minutes long. And then in the middle somewhere, the person just screams. Like really hardcore screams. Yeah.
James.
Hey, Dad, I kind of have a weird request.
Okay.
Can you film the dogs with headphones in them and then send me the video?
You mean dogs wearing earbuds?
Yeah. Make sure to film it horizontally.
I don't think they won't keep earbuds in their ears.
The very first comic I drew was this fan-made Garfield comic that I did when I was like 9. This was the Garfield comic that came out when I was born. Okay, back to Twilight.
Hello?
James, we found it.
What did you find?
The Garfield comic, man!
So remember how I said the first comic I made was a Garfield comic? Of course you remember, I just showed you a clip of it. So apparently my mom kept it. That just amazes me. I need to call her, hold on.
Hello?
Hey, Mom, I just want to say that you have a hoarding problem. Like, seriously, you need to throw some stuff away once in a while. Okay, bye. Man, I love her. Did you know the creator of Garfield, Jim Davis, is 70 freaking years old? And he's still making Garfield? How do you even... And he's made 14,000 comics? Oh, he has co-artists, and he doesn't even draw them anymore. Well, I just lost a bit of respect for my hero. If you guys wanted to start reading Garfield, you have a lot of catching up to do. So you know I love Garfield, it was a big inspiration to me, so much so that the very first comic I ever made was about Garfield. And I know in the video I said that I made it when I was like 9, but looking back at this, I want to say that I was like 6 months old. It's that bad. So, everyone shut up, and without further ado, this is the very first comic I made. Okay, let me explain some stuff. Let's go over this panel by panel. See how there's a graphic in this corner here? Well, Jim would make a unique graphic on every Sunday comic. So this is a Sunday comic, everyone. That means it's in color. Orange is a color. So the first panel, there's Odie, Garfield, and John. And John is saying, "Happy birthday! It's Garfield's birthday." And they're about to eat this physically impossible-looking cake. So there's this running joke in the Garfield comic that Garfield hates his birthday because he's getting way older. He's in his late 30s now! Jeez! So keep that in mind, because in the next panel... Wah! You might not be able to tell from the comic, but that's the sound of a fire truck pulling up. Because in panel number 3, there's firefighters saying, "Where's the fire?" And you know they're firefighters because this guy's holding a fire hose. That's a hose, okay? I was 6, you perverts! I just want to point out that I spelled fire like how it should be spelled. F-I-R. Really, this is the wrong way if you think about it.
fiery. In case you didn't get the joke, there's so many candles on Garfield's cake that it was enough to warrant a visit from the firemen, because Garfield is so old that he just has a bunch of candles on his cake. And then in the next panel, John explains to the fireman that there was nothing to worry about. My cat just having a B-day. Garfield's still confused, though. And then in the next panel, the cake is falling apart as we speak, and we hear another sound effect. It's beep, beep. Now, if we follow the speech bubble, we can clearly see that the sound is coming from the ceiling. John already knows what's happening because he says, "Oh no." And then in a brand new color, blue, it starts raining on them. It was the sprinkler from above. John runs away going, "Ah!" You know, something similar happened with sprinklers in the Incredibles movie. Oh shoot, I gotta call it The Incredibles 1 in case you're watching this after June 2019. So if I got inspiration from The Incredibles 1, which came out in 2004, that would mean I would be a minimum of 8 years old. So maybe I did make this comic when I was 9. That is, I'm assuming I stole that joke from The Incredibles movie, which I wouldn't put past myself. Alright guys, what if I told you there was a second Garfield comic that I made? I'm a little hesitant to show you because, I don't know what's going on in this one. So let's look at it and see if we can figure it out together. So it starts with a Garfield graphic. It's another Sunday comic. It doesn't seem as excited as the other one, though. Then in panel one, we see... what is that? I think that's a toothbrush and that's toothpaste. And it says Teth on it. Okay, panel two. John walks up to said Teth brush and Teth paste. And then he says, "They say you should use to pee big tooth past." I was in honor classes, you know. Then it looks like he's about to brush his teeth with a massive teeth brush, and then, "Garfield, that's not pee, sis." And then, I don't even know. I don't know what that is. And then, there's two? And one's green? And then we see Garfield say, "Yes, it is." So, like I said, I don't know what this one's about. I don't know what the joke is. I just don't get it. So I will make you an offer. I will give $20 to anyone that explains what this comic is trying to do. Actually, let's make it a prime $23. So $23 to anyone who can decipher this. I will be taking your guesses on Twitter and in the YouTube comments, and I will give out the $23 to whichever explanation I think explains the comic the best. So not necessarily the first person to get it will get the $23, just whichever one I see first.
This brick is alive. Not convinced? Well, what if I did this?
I'm gonna do a backflip!
That's gonna look so cool, Brickathy!
What are you boys doing?
Brickathy's gonna do a backflip, Grandma!
Are you convinced now? Did the brick feel more alive? I mean, sure, it's still a brick that can't move on its own, but maybe because I put googly eyes on it and gave it a family, you can connect with this brick, and it made you feel emotions. Convincing you that something inanimate is animate is the main goal of the animate ore. They're nothing more than deranged frauds. For the last century, animators have innovated new techniques and styles to this medium, taking it from a spinning wheel that doesn't even use electricity to Spider-Verse. And today, I'm going to talk about all the processes and innovations that have brought the medium of animation to right now. But first, let's go all the way back to the beginning of film, when it was all black and white and people had to put up text whenever they talked. Early on, filmmakers discovered a very simple trick to make anything appear alive in front of a camera. And that simple trick was called... You're filming something, and then stop the camera, and then move the thing slightly, capture a new image, move the thing again, and continue to do that a tedious amount of times. On the film, that thing now magically looked like it move on its own. And with this technique, you could make literally anything appear to be moving. Anything. But some filmmakers took this art form to an extreme level and created whole characters out of clay and a posable metal wire system called an armature. Now, animators can sculpt unique characters that bend and pose in much more believable ways. With stop motion, you don't need to hire a real dinosaur or giant monkey to make a movie about a dinosaur or giant monkey. I'm sorry you didn't get the job, Phil. You know, I just had a crazy idea. What if we made our entire puppet's head interchangeable?
Now they can make any facial expression and mouth shape possible. We will have to sculpt out hundreds of different heads, though, but, I mean, come on, that'll be fun. That's why we're extreme, baby! Stop-motion movies are still being made and enjoyed to this day, and while new technology does help make the overall process easier, animators are still using the same techniques that were used on King Kong back in the 1920s, where they carefully pose out a character's every movement, frame by frame. In order. Stop motion is a medium that I can't even begin to understand how they do, let alone make it look good, you know? Having a stop motion character in gravity-defying poses, making hundreds of different faces, is done solely to make the character feel more alive. And sometimes, to help sell the realism, animators will mimic quirks that only happen in live-action films. I always chuckle when I see a lens flare in an animated movie, because, like, where did you come from? There's not even a camera lens. Unlike me, though, who's always got a camera rolling. Hey, how's it going? Uh-oh. Oh, no! Did you catch that? Did you see the lizard eating a bug? Oh, we got him. Now let's rewind the clip and pause right here. This lizard moves so fast that the camera can't even capture its movements correctly, and he transmogrifies into an amorphic blob that barely even resembles a lizard. But do not fret, dear viewer. This is called motion blur, and is absolutely natural. Fast-moving objects are hard to see in real life anyway, so this blurry blob only showing up for one frame actually helps sell the idea that this little guy is moving quickly. If you watch any movie frame by frame, you'll find motion blur everywhere, and you won't even notice. So how do animators who are taking hundreds of still photos handle this naturally occurring phenomenon with things in motion? Easy, they'll draw smear. Animators draw their own blurry blob frame to mimic fast movements. Bodies can stretch, arms can multiply. Basically, we can sneak in nightmares as long as it's only shown for one frame. Smears, while being very fun to draw, can look very weird and goofy on their own. But in the context of the whole shot, you barely even notice they're there. Okay, maybe now you'll notice them, but that's only because I pointed them out. And since animators are bad boys and don't play by the rules, they can make smears out of anything. Even in stop motion, we can sculpt a physical smear frame like how they did in Laika's Paranorman, which, if you haven't seen, is going to be your new favorite movie. Smear frames can be used anytime, anywhere. Unless you were an animator in the 1920s and 30s and you didn't know about them back then. In that case, you would have been animating something called... In the 1920s and 30s, animators were still figuring out some core principles of animation. Turns out there's 12 of them. Smear frames were used sparingly during this time, with animators usually only drawing characters with multiple limbs to show fast movements. The stretchy, wacky, and spiritually ascending smears that you all know and love weren't really used until the 1940s. Rubber hose characters have noodly, almost hose-like limbs that bend in all sorts of anatomically defying ways. Look at Mickey Mouse's noodle arms that I can now legally show you. The reason characters look like this is because drawing noodle arms and not worrying about anatomy is easier to draw. But like, just because something has noodle arms doesn't mean it's bad, you guys. What these animators were able to accomplish with the technology, if you could even call it that, is nothing short of dark magic. And the very same studio that made Steamboat Willie wanted to push the envelope and show the world that animation could be more. It doesn't just have to be noodly characters with Pac-Man eyes. They were going to animate a realistic woman with proportional arms that don't move in weird, exaggerated ways. And oh god, her noodle arms are moving in weird, exaggerated ways. In 1934, Disney released a short called The Goddess of Spring, being their first attempt at animating a character with what was supposed to have real human anatomy. They still had a lot to learn, obviously. Now, animating a quote-unquote anatomically correct human is actually a much harder task than you might realize, and that's because of the uncanny valley. Get more and more human characteristics, we hit an interesting point right here when something looks almost like a human, but is just a little off. Our pattern recognition brains start setting off alarm bells and go, ugh, something is definitely wrong with that almost human. I am entering fight or flight right now. So if you're trying to make something look as close to a human as possible, but are just a tiny bit off, everything crumbles.
The Goddess of Spring was still good practice for Disney because only 3 years later, they released the world's first fully animated feature film, Snow White. Can you really blame Disney for going 6 times over budget to make this movie? I mean, just look at how these human characters are moving. 10 years before Snow White, animated humans looked like this. So going from this to this in only 10 years? How? I can't get over how real these human characters look sometimes. Almost too real. Well, I think you're old enough to learn about the dangers of rotoscoping is the process of taking real-life footage and then manually tracing over every frame, resulting in an animation with unreal levels of realism. And I say unreal derogatorily. You're basically slapping a cartoon filter over live-action footage, but instead of simply slapping, you're spending multiple hours doing mindless and tedious drawing. Rotoscoping is not the same as filming a human actor and then later referencing that footage, like what Disney did for Sleeping Beauty or Alice in Wonderland or any movie ever because animators use references all the time. People had figured out how to rotoscope other people long before Snow White. So of course Disney, who was trying to convey real human movement, rotoscoped some shots. The problem with rotoscoping is that we start to sneak our way back to the bottom of the uncanny valley. Animated characters often do and should break the laws of physics. They can squash and stretch into weird proportions and be drawn in unique and interesting poses. And look, Snow White is still a masterpiece of a movie. The rotoscoping is fine, you barely notice it. It's good, it's a good movie, and it made Disney a lot of money. Also, how did Walt animate these shots of things reflecting in the water in 1937? What, did they put special glass over paintings to make it look distorted or something? Who would be crazy enough to do that? If you made a whole movie entirely rotoscoped, what you end up with is Ralph Bakshi's The Lord of the Rings. Notice anything off about these characters' movements? Look at how Gandalf moved just a year ago in The Hobbit. Now, Lord of the Rings. Hobbit. Lord of the Rings. Almost every shot in this movie was rotoscoped, and the shots that weren't used live-action footage with a filter over it. I'm not saying that rotoscoping is bad. You just have to use it correctly. A character switching from traditionally animated to rotoscoped is incredibly funny, and always will be. The YouTuber Joel Havier makes very entertaining rotoscope skits that feel like a fever dream, and I mean that underogatorily. And a lot of music videos get away with rotoscoping because, admittedly, rotoscoping is a very cool visual. Now, I wish I could say the first Lord of the Rings movie was a hidden animation gem, but I don't know, it's not on my top 10, I'm sorry. It probably made a lot of nerds in the 70s happy, but thankfully The Lord of the Rings has been adapted into many other forms of media, like video games, Magic the Gathering cards, and anime. Anime? They're making a Lord of the Rings anime?
They're making a Lord of the Rings.
You thought Hollywood, California was the only place in the world making moving pictures? Japan's been making their own moving pictures too, and some of them are moving drawings. There are entire college courses on the history of anime, but you're not paying me tuition, so we're gonna have to skip over a couple things. A lot of early anime is now lost media because cinemas didn't preserve film back then, and an earthquake destroyed many studios in 1923. Some Japanese animators created shorts out of paper cutouts because buying thousands of celluloid sheets was too expensive, and they had some very unique character designs. And some Japanese animators took inspiration from Disney and made shorts that looked very similar to America's rubber hose characters. Then by the 1940s, some major world events happened that got most of the world involved, and both American and Japanese animation studios were affected. But after all that, in 1948, one studio called Japan Animated Films, later bought out by Toei Animation, set out to be the Disney of the East, and they made cartoons about magical schoolgirls, and are still in business to this day and made some other less popular shows. One animator who quit working at Toei created his own company and made an anime based off his comic about a robot boy. Hey, I kinda like that art style of drawing humans with big expressive eyes. Let's do more of that. That same year, another studio made an anime about humans controlling giant robots. I wonder if that's going to inspire a whole new genre. And this guy was commissioned by American studios to make stop-motion Christmas movies like Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. Meaning Rudolph is anime.
Nani?
By the 1960s, Japanese shows started airing on televisions all across the globe, and they continued to make unique and interesting stories with amazing animations that were beloved by billions of people and grew into extremely profitable franchises. Like, I'm talking the most profitable franchise. By the 1970s, Disney was still very much the animated movie gold standard, making big-budgeted movies with family-friendly values. Which is fine to do, kids love bright colors and talking animals that only cartoons can offer, but some studios realized that animation was a medium, not a genre, and made animated movies exclusively for adults. That's part of the reason why the first Lord of the Rings movie was entirely rotoscoped. It wasn't trying to be cartoony and over the top, it was trying to be real and gritty. Animation could be anything for anyone of any age. But really, if you think about it, there hadn't been a new way of showing people moving drawings since those very early days of black and white stop motion. In stop motion, you take a picture, move a figure, take a picture, move a figure. In cell animation, you take a picture, move a cell, take a picture, move a cell. Everything's just been a series of pictures moved manually in front of a camera this whole time? Always has been.
You've got mail.
Oh. It says the entire animation and film industry is about to be flipped onto its head forever and ever. Yeah, right. I'm sure this whole computer thing is just... Ever-increasing advancements of technology, we were able to achieve increasingly advanced... achievements, like putting a guy on the moon and drawing silly little cartoons more efficiently. Gone are the days of having to physically draw everything out on paper and underpay a team of hundreds of pretty girls to hand paint every frame. Now we can use this fancy new computer to render everything out for us. All we have to do is create a real-life mold of our real-life human hand, then draw 350 triangles onto that hand, then manually measure out the X, Y, and Z coordinates of 800 different data points. No, come on, this is going to be so much faster. Put that pencil down. Now we just program in a couple of keyframes and we get... Huh. We still don't have the processing power to render everything out. Oh, I know! We'll just point this long exposure camera at the computer screen. Get these art supplies out of here. This is the future. And when everything's finished rendering, we'll get this! A whole human hand moving on its own without having to draw a single frame. This process is exactly what Utah University student Ed Catmull did in 1972. And while it might not have been more efficient than drawing everything out by hand, it showed that computers were capable of rendering out three-dimensional animations. This was made after we landed a man on the moon, by the way, so don't tell me this was CGI. As the computer's processing power grew exponentially, more and more filmmakers started seeing the benefits of using computer-generated images in movies. A decade after Catmull digitized his hand, films like Tron showcased characters racing on mind-boggling computer-generated light cycles. This might look... you know, bad by today's standards, but these graphics were something that audiences had never seen before. Plus, the movie takes place inside of a computer, so this is probably what people thought the insides of a computer looked like anyways. At the time, computers did a great job at creating rigid, geometric shapes, and animators used that to their advantage. Characters would still have to be animated traditionally on cells, but objects that weren't going to change shape, like black cauldrons, could now magically fly in circles around our characters. Disney really showed off the computer's rendering power during the climax of The Great Mouse Detective, when these two rodents fought each other inside a clock tower and all the spinning gears were generated by a computer. Animators can now make any complex shape move in a three-dimensional space without having to draw a single frame. I mean, you know, except for the characters, they still very much had to draw those. Computer graphics were here to stay as Disney integrated more of them into movies like these cars in Oliver and Company or Eric's ship in The Little Mermaid, and then they stopped using cells entirely. Starting with The Rescuers Down Under, Disney no longer used cells and made movies entirely digitally with a program called CAPS. So if you ever wanted to own a cell of Joanna the Lizard eating an egg, that's too bad because they don't exist. Which fucking sucks because Joanna was the best goddamn lizard Disney ever made. Don't touch me! TV shows and anime still use cells till about the year 2000-ish, but eventually everyone switched to digital. Now to color a frame, all you had to do was... So computers were great at making rigid, non-flexible shapes, but has anyone ever tried to make... A group of computer scientists who were working for a small indie director named George Lucas were taking this art form to an extreme level and created whole characters completely generated by a computer. Then a small entrepreneur named Steve Jobs hired those computer scientists and made his own company, Pixar. Yes, Steve Jobs was one of the founders of Pixar, and he originally created the company to sell a high-end computer powerful enough to render 3D animations. But no one bought the computer because it cost $135,000. So the team scrapped the computer selling idea and just stuck with making computer-generated cartoons. But they soon discovered a unique problem. The computer had a hard time getting textures right, and everything, including babies, ended up looking like it was made out of plastic. So the team's clever workaround this dilemma was to make a movie with the entire cast of characters actually made out of plastic. Or ants. You know, people don't know what ants are supposed to look like. It's fine. Pixar continued to develop new processes to get the computer to generate unique textures and lighting, like simulating human hair or fur, or lighting things in such a way to make everything appear underwater. No other studio was pioneering computer-generated images like Pixar was. And then in 2006, Disney bought Pixar. But I don't think Steve was too upset because 1 year later, he achieved his dream of selling a high-end computer. This time being a little more affordable. A little. Now, I want to squash any misconception that computers do all the animating. Animators still have to manually pose a character's body and facial expression off of a character's... build a complex system of nodes and bones that let them manually pose a character into any position possible. It's kind of like a digital stop-motion puppet, or an actual puppet without any of the strings. All CG characters are just their own complicated version of Pinocchio. Using character rigs is really the only way of animating things in three dimensions. But it's not like we can use rigs in 2D animation. Here in the second dimension, we don't have a fancy Z-axis. 2D animation can only be done by hand-drawing 24 new images every second. Except we don't, I lied. Even all the way back when characters were animated with paper and cells, animators wouldn't draw a whole new frame every frame. Usually, they would animate pieces of a character and paint each piece on its own cell. You remember Robin? They only drew one body and five different heads. But because cells are a physical object that get harder to handle the more you have, animators could only break a character up into two or three different pieces. But now, thanks to the computer, we can break up a character into as many pieces as we'd like four, or five, or 173! Have you ever played around with the free and revolutionary animation software Pivot Stick Figure Animator? If you're the type of person that says, "Oh, I suck at drawing. I can't even draw stick figures," then you're gonna love this program. On Pivot, you're given a pre-made stick figure or horse that have these joints that can be posed however you like. Each of these stick figure's limbs are just individual pieces that are connected in such a way that make it look like a stick figure. So to make these animations, we're not really drawing anything, we're just manually posing out a character like a digital puppeteer. I wasn't saying you can make a rig out of 173 pieces just to be funny. Because that's how many pieces I'm made out of. That's right, me! Even I'm a rig! And can I tell you a secret? Most TV shows use rigs too. Of course, hand-drawn traditional animation is still used to make these shows. It's not a lost art form or anything. But rigs are super useful at making still pretty high-quality levels of animation, but at a much cheaper cost. And as we all know, TV animation has to create more animation per budget. But maybe rig animation still isn't as cost-effective as you'd like. And maybe you're not a fan of the complicated puppet look, and you want something that looks more human. Well, there's one more animation process we can try, called motion. An actor inside one of these dorky ping-pong suits, a computer can pinpoint and record that actor's exact movements. Now we can take those movements, slap a cartoon character's model over it, and we get an animation that looks like... shit. Motion capture is the rotoscoping of 3D animation. It cuts costs, but the results are too human, and we're back at the bottom of the uncanny valley. That's why the kids from the Polar Express look so nightmarish, because they are following the exact movements of Tom Hanks.
Yes, Tom Hanks, the adult man, did some motion capture for the small, nameless hero boy from the Polar Express. There's probably a reason we haven't made a fully motion capture cartoon in over 10 years. Because it looks weird. But I mean, that didn't stop one of these movies from winning an Oscar in animation. And before you ask, no, it wasn't Monster House or Tintin. It was Mars Needs Moms. Duh. Just like rotoscoping, motion capture can be used correctly. Computer-generated characters acting side-by-side real human actors look decent. It's not that jarring that these creatures who exist in a live-action world are moving just like live-action people. And let's not forget all the VTubers who use motion capture technology to bring their jiggly assets to life. No matter what method someone uses to try and convince you that something else is alive, I think is incredibly cool, and I hope you think it's cool too. But maybe you don't think it's cool, and you don't care about animation, and you just put this video on in the background while you were cleaning. That's totally fine, I do that all the time. I just like learning about how all my favorite animated pieces of media get created, because it's not always the same process. And I think it's great that new technology is allowing anyone to express themselves in whatever way possible. A person expressing themselves. Those are the three key words here. From the big studios that are just now pioneering new and interesting styles with digital animation, to the indie studios that have access to incredible technology which allow anyone working from their bedrooms in their pajamas to create some truly masterpieces of animation. So, if you're the type of person that likes to trick people into thinking that something is alive, then you deserve all the respect in the world. In fact, here are some cool people that made the animation in this video possible. Hello, you just made it to the end of this video. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm still trying to figure out this VTuber model, so I'm over-enunciating my words. The technology behind this is beyond my comprehension. If you're still deciding what to get for the holidays, then great news. We have mystery boxes over on my website, so you can leave the deciding up to us. Now, if you'll excuse me, I'm gonna go take a nap. Are you still watching? Oh yeah, she's coming back. A Pokemon Nuzlocke is a set of rules that turn a normal playthrough of Pokemon into a hardcore playthrough of Pokemon. You're only allowed to catch the first Pokemon you see per route, and if any of them faint, they actually don't live anymore, and you can never use them again. The game I will be Nuzlocking will be Pokemon Ruby. Not because I'm copying Jaden, but because Gen 3 is my favorite generation, and out of the three games, Ruby was the one I played as a kid and bought with my own money. It was $40. Imagine paying that much for a copy of the game now. Also, full disclosure, I've seen other PokeTubers who have a deep, uncanny knowledge of this game and use calculators to make the best, most optimal plays, but I'm not quite at that level yet, so I might make choices that some could consider suboptimal. I thought grass was, like, super effective against water. Why is he super effective against me? But if you can forgive me and look past all that, then let's get out of this truck and start our adventure. Let's see. Someone's already picked Torchic, and when I played this as a kid, I picked Treecko. So that means we're left with Kipmud! After defeating my rival's Treecko, I headed to Oldale Town and caught my first Pokemon that would be joining our team, Floof the Poochyena. I'm guessing naming Pokemon after pets is very common in Nuzlocke. By the way, this is how Floof's very first fight went.
Oh! Oh! Oh my god.
Hey! Do you want to learn how to catch Pokemon? No. I'm good. Well, that's too bad. First, you want to get him weak by throwing tiny rocks at him. Traveling through Route 104, I caught
a Zigzagoon!
Iggy the Zigzagoon. I'm probably not going to train her up or anything, but she will be useful teaching useless HMs to. What's that, Iggy? You have an ability where you pick up random objects? And you picked up a revive? Oh, Iggy. I can't use these. Wandering through Petalburg Woods, some guy asked me if I'd seen any Pokemon named
Shroomish.
The main reason Gen 3 is my favorite is because the best Pokemon ever, Breloom, makes his debut in this game. Why, if I found a Shroomish in this forest, I would probably react like this.
This guy was being truthful.
I named Shroomish Goat because not only is he the greatest of all time, but because I was also working on this other video about goats, so I had a lot of goats on the mind. We made it to Rustboro Town and challenged Roxanne, the rock-type gym leader, but thankfully we picked the water starter, so, you know, Kidmup, do your thing. I caught a Talo on Route 116, and keeping with the naming Pokemon after pets theme, I named him RE2. Not to spoil anything, but don't get too attached to RE2, Jaden. We sailed to Juford Town and saw that the second gym was a fighting-type gym, so that meant fighting-type weakness. It was RE2's time to shine.
He's, like, actually a higher level. I didn't like that. He's too high of a level.
Despite being a lower level, we decided to wing it and managed to defeat everyone's Pokemon, only having to tap out at Brawly's Makahuita, which Kidmup mopped the floor with. Hey, when did you start walking on two legs, Kidmup? The next HM we learn is this terrible move, Flash. The only thing Flash is good for is lighting up a dark cave that technically isn't even required to progress through the game if you know where you're going. I, however, do not. Currently, Goat is the only one on the team who can learn Flash. But I'm like 80% sure once a Pokemon learns an HM move, they can't unlearn it. So I really don't want to teach this S-tier Pokemon an unforgettable F-tier move. Oh boy, an Abra! I bet he can learn Flash. Oh boy, a Zubat! Okay, I'm kind of fudging the rules here. This Zubat wasn't technically the first Pokemon I saw on this route, but does it even count as an encounter if all you do is look at a Pokemon and then they teleport away?
Excuse me?
Look, I just need this useless Pokemon to learn this unrequired move. Zubat, I'm calling you Mr. Flash and immediately teaching you...
No!
Goat, you can learn Flash.
Yay!
After clearing out Team Magma from a museum, we were ready to take on Watson, the electric-type gym leader. Luckily, we picked the water ground starter, so... Kidmup, do your thing. Now what? Do I go here? Here? How did I get here? During my wandering, both the Pokemon I named after pets evolved into bigger versions of themselves, and Goat learned Headbutt.
Can I get rid of Flash?
No!
Hey, lady, I'm kind of lost, so I'm entering random houses and asking NPCs where I should go.
Oh, you have harbor mail? I'll trade you that for my coin case.
Coin case?
You know, for gambling.
Gambling? Listen, I don't have a problem. The reason I'm this excited is because one of the prizes you can win at the casino is a Pokemon. A Pokemon that may help me build the perfect team. So, before I checked what the prizes actually were, I bought 500 coins for a measly 10,000 Pokédollars.
Just TMs? Just dolls? I just wasted a lot of money, didn't I?
Good news, though. Goat evolved into his perfect form and learned Mach Punch.
Right.
Eventually, I talked to the right NPC, taught Iggsy Rock Smash, and while exploring a fiery path, I caught my first fire-type Pokemon.
Okay.
Numel.
Let's go, man!
Even though Numels can be found in the desert, have a big hump on their back, and evolve into something called... Camerupt. For some reason, I never looked at this Pokemon and thought, camel. I always thought, fire cow. So that's why I named her Cooked Beef. Then, on Route 114, we encountered a Zangoose.
Hello!
I have no clue what this Pokemon does, but it looks way cooler than all the Oddishes and tiny birds I kept running into, so it had to be awesome. Cooked Beef, the 9 levels you have on this goose are more than enough to weaken it. Hit him with an ever...
Oh!
Cooked Beef! So, my only fire type died to a quick attack that did 50 damage. Zangoose, or should I say Beef Eater, you can join the team for now, but just know, We could have killed you at any point. It was a challenge not to kill you.
We headed up a mountain and fought Maxie, the leader of Team Magma, who had his own floof Pokemon, which Goat took care of, and he had his own evolved cooked beef.
I sure wish I had one of those on the team. Hey, Beef Eater, why don't you make yourself useful and fight that Crobat?
Okay, that's kind of cool. As we headed down the mountain, who did I encounter but...
Who's the new Pokemon?
Another Numel. Immediately, I abandoned Beef Eater to make room for... Return of King. Before we take on Gym Number 4, I think I figured out a way to get Goat to forget the move Flash without having to beat him over the head with a 2x4. A little Pidgey told me that Goat was about to learn a new move at his next level. So, by placing him in the Pokemon Daycare and doing some light cardio outside, he'll level up, learn the new move, and forget Flash. And my plan worked like a charm.
Yeah.
It really sucks that this is the only way to get Pokemon to forget an HM move. You'd think they'd have some, I don't know, a move deleter NPC or something. Gosh. Now, you'd think that since I picked the water starter, that the fire type gym wouldn't be an issue. But it was. Floof and I quickly learned why biting lava was a bad idea.
Okay!
Thankfully, Kidmup, who I don't know why I didn't send out first, took out both of Flannery's Slugmas with no issue. But then, she sent out Torkoal. Even though Kidmup was using a super effective move, he only did this much damage. Meanwhile, Torkoal's body slams were doing this much damage. And paralyzing us. Okay, Goat, I know you're the goat, but you understand why you can't fight a fire turtle, right? RE2, looks like you're up. Finish her off with a steel wing.
Ah! Dude!
RE2! No!
What do we do? What do we do?
None of you are great choices. What I really need is a turn to heal up Kidmup, but... Hey, Iggy. Are you aware of the concept... taking one for the team? Given the dire circumstances, this felt like the best choice. Sorry, Iggy. With Kidmup healed, we managed to get Torkoal's health really low, but then Kidmup refused to finish the fight because he was, in his words, immobilized by love. Kidmup, I know you're letting this turtle body slam you on purpose, and you're sick for it!
Do you really think we have a future together?
Okay, Goat, I know this is a fire turtle, but she's mostly using body slams. Could you please punch this turtle's head off without falling in love? We earned our fourth gym badge, but it wasn't without some casualties. RE2 and Iggy, we wouldn't have made it this far without you. Thanks for everything. We traveled into a sandstorm where I picked up two Pokemon, this fossil, and this weird Pokemon I've never seen before, Baltoy. Alright, King, my second chance at a fire type. I know this isn't your natural habitat, but why don't we train here in the desert for a bit? Oh, you found a Baltoy. I just caught one of those. I'm not sure what its moves are, though.
Nuts.
God! Okay, team. I know everyone is upset this thing shares a species with the Pokemon who blew up King, but it possesses psychic abilities that I believe could be very useful. So, please everyone give a warm welcome to King Eater. No one step on it. We headed back to Petalburg City and faced Gym Number 5, my dad. Also, I brought Odd One-ish just in case we had another Iggy-type situation.
Am I an integral member of the team?
You sure are, bud. Despite a few close calls...
Who? Dude! Dude! Dude. Finish him off. No!
Everyone, including Odd One-ish, made it out alive.
Oh my god.
Good thing we have free healthcare. I don't know what I'd do if someone took away my free healthcare. Not right now, Goat. Across the water on Route 118, I caught Pikachu the Electrike.
Great.
I don't know, he's electric like Pikachu, and his head kind of looks like pickles, so... Whatever, having an electric type on the team is huge. After inspecting all the Pokemon I had, I figured Mr. Flash's flying poison moves could be useful. So I evolved him into Golbat and then, here you go, daycare lady.
Alright, my favorite Pokemon, who wants some ice cream? Gosh, I love you guys. I couldn't ask for a better team right here.
At Fort Tree City, we were ready to take on Winona, the flying-type gym leader. Wait, this weird lizard's blocking our path. Kidmup, can you? Oh, cool, you're back on four legs again. Also, Pikachu, why are you blue? The only thing that stood between me and Winona was this incredibly hard two-piece puzzle.
How do I get through this? Oh, figured out.
Pikachu was able to spark Winona's Swellow, and Kidmup, through sheer willpower, tanked all of Altaria's earthquakes, narrowly avoiding death by 8 hit points. Good work, Kidmup! Pikachu, you know what to do. I found a TM for Ice Beam on an abandoned ship, and King Eater, you can learn Ice Beam? I'm sorry it's taken me this long to realize how awesome of a Pokemon you are. You know, King Eater, with you on the team, I think we'll be okay without a fire type. I entered Lily Cove City, and my rival wanted a rematch. Kidmup knocked out her Swellow, no problem, but then she sent out Grovyle. Ooh, I know the perfect matchup for this. King Eater, why don't you show this grass type that new move you learned?
Dude! Ah! Are you gonna use the hyper potion? No!
No! I can't believe I got that upset at losing a Pokemon that before this challenge, I had never even considered playing with. If any members of the Claydol lover community are watching, I'm sorry, I didn't know he hated grass. All right, team, we're not fighting any more gyms until each one of you is in peak physical shape. Floof, why haven't you evolved into Houndoom yet? What about this fossil? Is this fossil any good? We picked the plant one. We got the plant. What about Mr. Flash? Has anyone seen Mr. Flash? Why hasn't that loser evolved yet? Hey, buddy. So listen. We're friends, right? You know, Goat had to stay in the daycare once. Yeah, it was to forget the move Flash. Look, Mr. Flash, I know I technically shouldn't have even caught you, and I named you after a garbage move I thought you could learn, but I want you to evolve so you can be the best version of you on the team. Don't you want to join the team? I have this soothing bell you can hold on to. Welcome to the team, Mr. Flash. With the team stronger than ever, I surfed my way to an island that had a Pokemon graveyard inside a tall building. And for the first time ever, I could actually grieve with the other trainers. That was a great battle, dude.
Yeah, it was. Here's some money.
So, Kidmup was holding an amulet coin, so you actually owe me 600. We defeated more Team Magma grunts at the top of the tower, and on our way down, I caught what I thought was going to be a super awesome Pokemon, but turned out to be a little disappointing.
Let's go!
My third chance at a fire type, my son, the Vulpix, which I immediately evolved into Ninetales. Why was she a disappointment? I don't know. You'd think a fire type would have no problems defeating a Gloom. But alas. I'm not saying Ninetales is a lame Pokemon. I'm saying mine specifically was. Floof and Kidmup easily cleared the Psychic Gym with Shadow Ball and Surf. And with that, we just have one more gym before we... Is the sun on fire? So I haven't really been paying attention to the story, and now the legendary Pokemon Groudon is angry. And as much as I would have liked to have Groudon on the team, I never found the Master Ball, so we're not risking it. Oh, hey, Wallace. Oh, you're the water-type gym leader? Oh, I hope my fighting grass Pokemon will be okay. No, you don't have to fight the Celio. I'll get Floof to do that. And with our 8th gym badge, we could finally travel through Victory Road and face the Elite Four.
Aren't you forgetting something?
I don't know how you want me to respond to that.